Plain Scotch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, We Need to Do Something, Zone 414, Only Murders in the Building, and the Pen 15 animated special on Hulu. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring the original 1984 version of Doom. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The big piece of news this week is some shuffling on the release schedule, which I'm not surprised at in any way. Paramount, which has already moved Clifford the Big Red Dog, weirdly enough, that was the bellwether for all this, but they moved Clifford the Big Red Dog out of September a couple weeks ago. I wouldn't be surprised if that thing just ends up on Paramount Plus or they do a hybrid release for that. But more importantly, the Tom Cruise double feature of Mission Impossible and Top Gun Maverick have been taken off the schedule and moved until next summer. Reminds me a little bit of the things that were happening around March and April of 2020 when things started shifting around. Or what happened, weirdly enough, around Labor Day last year, when Tenet didn't light up the box office and everybody scrambled to put their stuff in different places. All eyes right now are on Shang-Chi and The Legend of the Ten Rings. I've been seeing numbers predicting a box office of $45 to $50 million this weekend domestically, hoping for a worldwide total of $90 to $100 million. And those are somewhat conservative estimates considering that Black Widow, in a hybrid release, made $80 million. But there's a couple things that are different. First of all, Black Widow is a well-known character. Scarlett Johansson is a big name, and it had other big names in there, like even David Harbour from Stranger Things, but people like Rachel Weisz and Florence Pugh. And Shang-Chi doesn't have any really big names attached to it, and it's not a well-known character in the Marvel Universe. So it's not a one-to-one comparison, and with the exception of maybe The Incredible Hulk, that would be, even with that $45 to $50 million range, that would be one of the lowest opening weekends for a Marvel movie. But, you know, you got to take everything into account in the middle of a pandemic, which we are still in. And the reason all eyes are on Shang-Chi is that that does not meet those numbers. You are going to see an exodus of films from the fall, and it'll be the biggest exodus you've seen in 3,500 years. Because after Shang-Chi, the next one that could fall is No Time to Die, which needs $1 billion to break even because it costs $250 to $300 million to make, and they're locked in with the date. Every time they've moved it, and they've moved it multiple times, it costs more money in millions of dollars to get the release date and the marketing and everything, and they're already putting it in festivals. It's going to premiere at the end of the month. So we all know that this is definitely happening on the 8th. But if No Time to Die does not give some oomph to the box office, it is going to be a desert out there till the end of the year, more or less. There is more to be written in the box office numbers, and for the next month, it's going to be very interesting to see the reaction. Because if this does not take off with Shang-Chi and No Time to Die, everyone is going to still try and figure out how to do a hybrid model. I have really appreciated the hybrid model that Warner Brothers has been doing, just putting it on HBO Max. And that's not free, people. It costs $15-16 a month to get that service. But Disney, I think, is actually the closest to getting that hybrid model to work. Netflix doesn't have to worry about it because it is almost exclusively online and they only do limited theatrical releases for stuff if it's like award films. Amazon is generally following the Netflix model with its movies, but it's still trying theatrical exclusives. You still see theatrical movies that are Amazon movies that aren't on the service, but they're moving towards that anyways, and that's what you saw. You're going to see that this weekend with Cinderella. I was not given a screener for it. I from what I hear, it's probably a good thing because I didn't sound like I wanted to see it, but it's in theaters right now. But Cinderella is also on Amazon. If you have a Prime account, you can watch it there. So Netflix and Amazon are kind of playing around in the same basket. Netflix is much more invested into the online model. And I've said this before, Netflix is not going to roll over and let everybody just take this over again. Hulu has turned into kind of just a sink for adult-minded content that's not appropriate for Disney Plus right now, and plus some Hulu originals that are meant not for theaters, but just for streaming. And sometimes you got some pandemic drops like Run or Happiest Season last year, but I don't see Hulu gobbling those up. Of course, that may change if Shang-Chi and No Time to Die don't do well. Paramount Plus and Peacock seem to be utilizing their stuff for children's movies, which is a smart move. I think that worked for Paw Patrol for sure. I think that worked for the Boss Baby sequel. But then you got stuff like Sony and MGM and Lionsgate. They don't have anything major set up. And I think that's the problem with MGM running James Bond, is that they don't have an option. Now, they could sit there and put it on pay-per-view for $50 a pop. Who knows? That's a possibility, but they just can't do that now. And they don't have anywhere to fall back to. They either have to release the movie, sell it, or not. Disney has the best thing going. And I didn't think this was going to work a year ago when they started trying it, but this seems to be working for them. Disney Plus itself is all original content. It's all owned by Disney, so they have no licensing fees to worry about. They don't have to pay one dime to any other production partner. I mean, there's some things I'm sure there, and there's royalties they gotta pay, but they don't have to pay the rights to show the Marvel movies because they own Marvel. And then they just have to figure out their pricing structure. It may not be a $30 all the time. It might scale from $30 based on the size of releases. I would not be surprised if they start changing the numbers. If they do another Star Wars movie and it's going to be a big, big, big movie, I can see them charge $50. Heck, I would have paid for that in 2015. But Disney is most primed. And if Shang-Chi does not work out, trust me, they're going to do this, because October is going to look grim if these things aren't at least moderate box office hits. We'll see. But like I said, there's more to be written. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is The Power of the Dog, which is in limited release on November 17th and on Netflix December 1st.
He's just a man. Only another man.
Peter!
I don't know what to make of this movie. The trailer doesn't give me much to go on. It's atmospheric. It's got some good actors to it. It's a Western. It's dusty. And that's about it. They whistle almost the Jurassic Park theme. I don't know. This could be great. I'm not terribly familiar with Jane Campion as a director, so I don't know. I mean, this is playing at festivals right now, and you're starting to see reviews come out of it, but you can't trust those because those are hoity-toity critics and not somebody like me, big manly man who understands the average person's views. Anyways, let's talk about the next one, which I do understand, and that is Creepshow Season 3, which is heading to Shudder on their 61 Days of Halloween on September 23rd.
Welcome. You're going to have to come closer.
Something's wrong.
We don't have much time.
It's here!
The stories were true.
This isn't a dream. This is really happening.
They're dead. They're all dead.
What did you do?
This is scary.
100%. Simple as that.
I love Creepshow. I grew up watching Creepshow, and I saw it in the theaters, the original one with Stephen King and George Romero, and I watched Creepshow on Shudder. I think it's a great series. It's a lot of fun. It evokes those kind of feelings of campy horror, but also still very violent and visceral horror. So yeah, I love the first two seasons of Creepshow. I like the Creepshow holiday special. I'm saying just bring more and I'm happy. So yes, I'm just thrilled that Creepshow is coming out with season 3. We will be talking about that on Shudder in a couple weeks. Anyways, that's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Zone 414 and the Pen 15 animated special. Welcome back to to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about Zone 414. A bounty hunter is hired by an eccentric scientist to find his daughter who has disappeared into a lawless zone where humans and androids coexist in a criminal underworld.
What do you know about Zone 414?
My city of robots. My androids. Companionship is rare these days.
Not my kind of place.
The task is my daughter, Melissa. 3 weeks ago, she went missing.
I need you to retrieve her for me.
Welcome to the Zone.
First off, I am going to immediately acknowledge this is very much inspired by Blade Runner. And that's nothing new. Blade Runner has been an inspiration for science fiction and action films for 40 years. It was ahead of its time. But one of the problems with a lot of movies, when they try to emulate Blade Runner, what they forget is what makes Blade Runner work is, yes, it has special effects. Yes, it has these epic shots of Los Angeles in the future and the sky and the Japanese woman on the giant TV and the flying cars and all that stuff. But what makes Blade Runner really work is the same thing that makes Star Wars, the original Star Wars, work. It still looks like a regular environment. It still looks like something you can walk into. Whereas if you look at something like, say, the Battlestar Galactica TV series from the 80s, they're walking into the most overly designed sets that are silly and ridiculous, and they look opulent but cheap at the same time. Blade Runner works because it still looks like it's what 2019 would have looked like in 1982. It didn't fall into cliche. I mean, it established certain cliches. But really, if you watch Blade Runner, once you get past those big establishing shots, everything's somewhat intimate, and it's just lighting and costuming, really, and set design. And that's one of the things that they do. Before I even talk about the movie, I mean, what the content of Zone 414 is, what I found impressive about this is it's clearly a low-budget movie. They're really working with limited funds. So they can't do Blade Runner 2049. They can't do these high-action, massive scenes. They can't do these big budgeted set pieces. And so what they do is they shoot it really tight. And in the background, they just drop some things in the background that make it look a little bit futuristic, or they put some neon in the background. And it takes you, then you sit there and you watch it and go, wait a minute, they're just shooting this in an empty warehouse. But because of how they shoot it, and they move the cameras, and they tighten up on their cameras, and you're focused on the actor, not on the background, You forget that you're just looking at this basically in a deserted warehouse with a little bit of neon light, but that works. It fools the brain because you're so used to seeing Blade Runner. And that's the whole thing. Yeah, they do the street scenes, but I mean, they don't have the massive amount of extras in there and the massive amount of set design, but they showed it tight enough that they maximize what they do. And I think it's kind of a feat of production design to make a $5 million movie. I'm not saying it's looking as good as Blade Runner, but I think it can emulate what it is. And it already has that sort of industrial look to it. And they can shoot it in darkness and grimness, and that works. So I was impressed with that. And that's what kind of kept my interest. And then, so then what it does is it deals with a lot of the same issues that we saw in Blade Runner about basically synthetic humans. And in this Zone 414 is basically a free for all. And people aren't supposed to interact with the androids outside of Zone 414. It's sort of verboten, but in 414, anything goes. And so, of course, there's a lot of, let's just say, pleasure models involved. And so that's the driving force to this criminal underworld that's taking place. But it's sort of this fantasy world for the demented. Now you're following Guy Pearce, and he ends up teaming up with this android. And her programming seems to have evolved beyond just a reactionary program. She seems to feel, actually have emotions and worth as a being beyond just a regurgitating and a garbage in, garbage out kind of thing. Which, you know, you can program a machine to do anything, but when the machine starts to believe, that's where you run into the problem. So it's dealing with a lot of these same themes about when is it sentient life, and when is it considered something you should protect? And when is it something that you should have compassion for? And yeah, it's just sort of like a throwaway low-budget sci-fi movie, but I thought that it handled it well. It, you know, the character interaction between the main guy and the android, I think really clicks and it works. And it's not going to be for everybody. And I know a lot of people are going to poo-poo it because it is very much a Blade Runner inspired piece. But I enjoyed it. I was impressed. So I'm going to have to say that Zone 414 kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Pen 15 Jacuzzi. This animated version of the award-winning Hulu series sees Maya and Anna on a trip to Florida where they deal with cute boys in a hot tub and an unflattering caricature drawing from a street vendor.
It's gonna be fun.
Yeah, I wonder if it's different in, like, Florida.
Woo, we here, Florida, baby!
Woo! Hey, no. You can't go in the pool when there's thunder.
Are you serious? No one is letting us start our good time.
Hey.
Oh, hey.
You two are cute.
But, like, what if one of us marries them?
Or both of us?
I sort of feel that.
Right?
If you've not watched Hulu's Pen 15 yet, I would caution, it's not for everybody. You know, it's very awkward. It's about these two middle school girls in the turn of the century, right around 2000. And they're played by the adult versions of them. You know, they're women in their 30s playing these preteens, really, because they're like 12 or 13. So they're awkwardly shaped and they have no social graces whatsoever. And it's them trying to navigate middle school. And it's very real. It has these very real things. And they're the only adults as kids. Everybody else in the kids are played by actual legitimately aged kids. And it's a real funny show. But you have to enjoy awkward, uncomfortable comedy for this. You're watching the girls just behave so self-destructively, but not in like a horrific manner, but just that's the way teenage girls are. Look, I grew up with a teenage girl in my house. I have a sister who's 2 years older than me. And I'm not saying that I was completely with it and cool or everything, but she was 2 years older than me. So I saw her going through everything 2 years before I went through it. And I could learn from her mistakes. And you know, everyone has their awkward stage, and your awkward stage is always in the worst time of your life to deal with your awkward stage. If you got in your awkward stage in your 40s, you just wouldn't care. I mean, am I awkward? I don't know, and I don't care. But when you're, you know, 13, it makes a difference. And it's another episode from the series. So it plays like an episode, but it's animated. So it does some interesting things, like this whole caricature, because they're on this vacation, they're just on this trip to Florida. And what it does show, it shows that allure Florida has. If you live in Florida, you're like, this is my backyard. It's blech, you know. But Florida is a vacation place to go. And when you're from the Midwest, you're like, oh my God, Florida. I can't believe people live there. Even though you got millions of people that live in Florida every year. But there is that allure to it and how it's a magical place to somebody north of the Mason-Dixon line. So it's a fun little look at trying to be a normal teenager in what would be considered this paradise, even though they're just at a crappy motel. They get this caricature made of them, and then they start drawing the characters as the caricatures because they internalize that. I mean, there's a lot of truth and reality to how these girls deal with life, and they don't always deal with it well. But it's very fun. It's worth checking out if you're a fan of Pen 15. So I'm going to have to say the Pen 15 Jacuzzi animated special kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Shang-Chi, and we need to do something. To Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. A Chinese-American man confronts his family's dark past when he's pulled back into the life of crime by his father.
Throughout my life, the Ten Rings gave our family power. If you want them to be yours one day, you have to show me you are strong enough to carry them.
You are a product of all who came before you. The legacy of your family. You are your mother. And whether you like it or not, you are also your father.
If there's anything I can tell you about Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, it's don't believe the hype. And that's not a bad thing. That's not me saying it's a bad movie. The hype's overdone. Hype can be a dangerous thing for a movie. a lot of times hype gets people excited about seeing a movie. And it can draw people to see the movie who haven't seen it. But the problem is, sometimes hype is put there because there's a desire for that movie to do better than it normally would. And that's a double-edged sword, because what happens is if you overhype something and you make it sound like it's going to be the greatest thing ever, people go see it and they go, well, it was okay. Or it wasn't as good as everybody was saying it is. And then you lose word of mouth. And I have a fear that that's going to happen with Shang-Chi. Now, first of all, let me just say, Shang-Chi is a perfectly fine movie. I enjoyed it. It's fun. It's a good Marvel movie. It's basically a martial arts story that's dropped into the Marvel universe. But it works. And it's got that Marvel brand of humor and action, and it's got great special effects, and it's certainly got a story you can follow. It's not boring or anything like that, and it's exciting, and it connects with a couple other movies, notably Iron Man 3. If you've not seen Iron Man 3 recently, not a bad idea to go check that one out. But the problem is there's this desire for it to do well for a couple reasons. First of all, it's an exclusive theater release, and there's this narrative going on, especially right now, that exclusive theater releases are the way to go because we got to get back to them. That's why Free Guy has been treated like Avatar for the last couple weeks, even though it's doing okay. And there is this desire for Shang-Chi to do extremely well, to say, oh, look, movies are back, baby. Marvel's back. People are coming to theaters. Not just through the exhibitors, but through the press, because the press likes it that way. But I'm here to tell you, it's not the beginning and the end of movies. I remember leaving my screening and the security guy there goes, oh, this is the most unique movie I've seen. And I go, what are you kidding me? There's an entire continent making movies like this. It's a kung fu movie. You know, it doesn't matter what country it's in. It's a martial arts movie. And these things follow a very specific story where there's somebody having a normal life, and then he gets kind of pulled back in a life of crime and has to go confront his family. He goes to this somewhat feudalistic village where he has to learn the ways of things and become better at what he does and become a better person, a better fighter, and a better warrior. And then there's a big conflict. That's your standard martial arts movie. And that is the plot of Shang-Chi. That's also the plot of Snake Eyes, actually. It was Japanese for Snake Eyes and this is Chinese. But even to a degree, Mortal Kombat earlier this spring kind of followed there was a lot more going on because they're trying to spin a lot of characters in there, but it still kind of had that template. And if you've watched any movies, they could be Japanese movies about samurai, they could be Chinese movies or Hong Kong movies about kung fu, that's a lot of these movies. And that's okay, that's great. It's a standard story and it absolutely works. But let's not pretend this is the most unique thing you've ever seen. It's unique to the Marvel Universe because it's the first time they've done this in this particular setting. But like I said, an entire continent makes movies like this. The other thing people, I think, they wanted to do well is because it's not the first Asian superhero. I think Benedict Wong would take issue with that going, guys, I was in Doctor Strange a couple of years ago. But it's the first main Marvel character that's Asian. You know, sort of like Black Panther was the first black superhero movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And yeah, you had War Machine, but he was a secondary Iron Man character. This is the first movie devoted to the actual story of the black superhero. And this is the first one devoted to an Asian superhero. And look, if you like martial arts movies, it's fun. It's great. I mean, it's got some great action. Some of the action is a little bit derivative. There's a subway fight that's derivative of a scene from Captain Marvel, and there's a fight in a building that's derivative from a scene from Skyfall, and it uses some great big spectacle special effects, so it's certainly a big screen movie. I mean, it's good. It's good. And they have decent characters in it, and it works, but it's not the beginning and end of movies. And I've heard people say, oh, this set Phase 4 perfectly. No, it doesn't. It teases Phase 4. It has elements from and characters from other Marvel movies show up. But if you want to talk about teasing Phase 4, oh my God. I mean, Loki and WandaVision tease Phase 4 way more than this does. I mean, heck, this last week's What If teases Phase 4 more than this movie does. And that's okay. It's a fine movie. It's absolutely worth seeing. And it's an adventure and it's fun. I don't feel that it's the beginning and the end of things, and I don't want to tell you that it is because I don't want to overhype the movie. It's worth seeing. It's good. So I'm going to have to say Shang-Chi and the Legends of the Ten Rings kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about We Need to Do Something. A family is trapped in their bathroom after a tornado almost crushes their house, but they are meant to confront something darker in their lives.
There's not going to be a tornado. It's just a thunderstorm. Everything's going to be okay.
It won't open. A tree is blocking the door.
Doesn't make any sense.
What doesn't make any sense?
We have neighbors. Someone would have come. They're all dead.
Why would you say that? What if it wasn't just a storm? I was scared.
Scared of what?
Of you.
We did something bad.
This is an independent film. It's released by IFC, and it's in theaters and limited theaters, and it's on VOD right now. So you don't have to leave the house if you don't want to. I mean, heck, if you have a tornado, this is a great thing to watch during it, or maybe not. The movie itself, I believe, was shot during the pandemic, and it has a cast of like five. It's this family, this husband and wife, and their two kids, and there's a couple scenes where the girl flashes back to stuff that happened with a couple people at school. But that's it. I mean, that's the cast. And almost the entire movie takes place in this bathroom where there's a tornado and then a tree falls on the house and it blocks the door and they can't get out. But when they're trying to get out, there's strange things out there. There's maybe something evil, you know, maybe there's, you're questioning whether it's real and what's real and what's not. And are these hallucinations? Is this actually happening in one person's mind? So it's very open-ended and stuff. There's a lot of weird stuff going on, but it does put you in, you know, at least the first half of it puts you in that position of saying, what would you do if you were locked in a room the size of a Volkswagen with your whole family and you can't get out and you can't eat because you're in the bathroom? You can go to the bathroom. You can drink water out of the faucet. You can take a shower if you want to. But even if you're going to go to the bathroom, you're going to be doing it with your entire family sitting 3 feet from you. So it shows how really that pressure cooker situation of putting people together in that type and not having a place to go, not having a place to escape, even for a little bit. I always talk about I drive and I travel places with my family and we'll get in a car and I say nothing brings a family closer together than cramming everybody into a steel prison and careening down the highway at 80 miles an hour. But at least then you could stop somewhere and you can get out and you can stretch your legs and go eat and go to the bathroom and you have a little bit of privacy. Then you get back in the car and you go. They are never given a chance to get out. And that's the challenge of this movie. It's effectively done as a sort of bottle episode of Hollywood. It's one single room for the most part and it's effectively shot and it does keep my interest. The biggest struggle I had with it is there's no real resolution. It's one of those movies when you have weird stuff happening, you either have to explain it or you have to run away from explaining it. But at a certain point, there's got to be something satisfying coming together. Even if you don't explain what it is, there's got to be some sort of resolution within it. And there really isn't as much of a payoff as I wanted. And that's my biggest beef with the movie. But otherwise, it was an interesting film, and it's worth checking out, and it's creepy, and it's weird, and it's officially horror movie watching season, because it's September, and I extend it now into September, because, well, that's what I do. Anyways, I'm going to say We Need to Do Something kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Only Murders in the Building and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring the original Doom. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue with the reviews and talk about Only Murders in the Building. This is a Hulu series. It dropped this week. It's on Tuesday. Had the first three episodes hit this week, and I think they're doing one episode then each week leading into the end of the series. That's the typical release schedule that Hulu does for their series. So I think there's 10 episodes total. This frustration I had is, before I even talk about the movie, I got the screeners for this and they're in like a digital package that they send me that I can watch with a password protection. And my family were watching it, and we were really getting into it, and they only gave us 8 episodes. So there's 10 episodes. But we got to the end, and I mean, we don't get to see the next two until, what, October or something, when everybody else does. So now, I'm not really burying the lead on this one. But let's play the trailer. Steve Martin and Martin Short headlined this series about a group of people living in a high-rise in New York City that start a true crime podcast based on a murder that happened there.
Tim Kono's death has been ruled a homicide, and apparently one of you did it.
I can't stop thinking about this.
Neither can I.
We should do our own true crime podcast.
We're going to go down there and look around for clues.
You want to come?
Do I want to break into a dead guy's apartment? Sounds like an afternoon.
Right now, the only thing that matters is that there's a killer on the loose in our building.
Oh, that is a very good line. Badly delivered, but a good line.
As I said in the blurb, this stars Steve Martin and Martin Short. And I love the two of them. I go back to when they were like younger comedians. I mean, I saw in the theaters when it came out, Three Amigos, stuff like that. And I love Steve Martin movies. I love Martin Short's movies, and some of their stuff's terrible. I mean, they both have done crap in their years. But it's also clear that they're friends and they've done stuff together, and it's nice seeing them get back together and do something. Now, obviously, the Steve Martin stuff, this is more of his modern level of stuff. I mean, he's not doing the over-the-top jerk, wild and crazy guy kind of thing, what he was doing with the Carl Reiner movies. And Martin Short, I mean, they're both in their, like, their 70s, so, you know, Martin Short can't go dancing around like Ed Grimley anymore. Now, they bring in Selena Gomez into this series, and I guess that's supposed to ground millennials. I would love to know the background of how she got involved and whose idea, because it sounds like she had met with Steve Martin or something, and they bounced ideas, and that's, it's not that they sought her out. It feels like she's involved in this from the beginning, and she's not just a throwaway character. It's not like the series said, well, we need somebody from the millennials to be in this movie. But the whole thing is Steve Martin and Martin Short, they both live in the building, and she has an apartment. She's living in, there's a reason why she's living there, but she is not on the lease. But the three of them, they're fans of a true crime podcast, and so they create their own, and it's about the murder that took place in the building. And there's a lot of twists and turns in it. Like I said, I've seen 8 episodes of the 10. And they have a lot of twists and turns. They have a great cast. There's a whole bunch of people in it, and they keep showing up. And they don't just drop the entire cast in the first episode. You get reveals of new people in the cast all the time. If you watch the trailer, you see a lot of the people. But it's neat to just kind of watch the show unfold. And the story's clever. You get Steve Martin and Martin Short's brand of comedy. It's a little bit more low-key, but they command their roles very, very well in these classic, you know, because Steve Martin is an actor, but he was on a TV show and he's sort of a has-been. And Martin Short is an old Broadway director and he's still clinging to whatever fame he had. And I mean, it's just a clever little series. Now, I'm going to warn you if you're, you know, it does have some foul language in it. They throw around some blue language. So like my mother, I don't know if my mom would love this show as much because it does dip into vulgarity now and then. But I mean, still, this series is a lot of fun, and it's an actual mystery to it as well. And that's a fine line to walk. You know, you see these series, you know, something like Psych or Monk, or there's even this thing on Roku called the Maple Mysteries or something like that. And of course, the Roku stuff, it's from the old Quibi content that's like 10 minutes long each. And those are broad comedies that don't have a great mystery embedded to them. But this one does have a lot of characters and clues, and you kind of have to follow it. But you do enjoy watching these characters just sort of be crazy characters. But it does present you with a legitimate mystery that I think is quite well written. So yeah, I have to say, Only Murders in the Building, I had a blast with this one, so I'm going to say it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent! Yes!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on Dune. No, not the Denis Villeneuve movie that's coming out next month. I'm talking about the original movie that was made in 1984 by David Lynch. It's coming out this week on a new 4K release, so I thought this was the perfect time to revisit Dune and check it out. So David Lynch directs this ambitious adaptation of Frank Herbert's novel about interstellar trade, politics, and revolution.
You are about to enter a world where the unexpected.
Many dangers exist on Arrakis.
The unknown.
An incredible secret has been kept on this planet.
And the unbelievable meet.
I see two great houses.
Where kingdoms are built on earth that moves.
And we have worm sign, the likes of which even God has never seen.
You have to understand sort of what was going on at the time this movie was being made. David Lynch had been passed up to direct Return of the Jedi. And you know, you sit there and you think, why would you even consider him? Because he does such bizarre stuff. But aside from Eraserhead, that was way out there, and that was sort of his midnight movie that put him on the map, he had done The Elephant Man. So David Lynch wasn't as weird then or known to be weird then as he is now. And he was considered to direct Return of the Jedi, and they didn't do it. And everybody was trying to do a Star Wars movie. But you got to remember, this was deep into the 80s by this point, and we already had the cute robots, and, you know, you just had the Ewoks in the Return of the Jedi. So everybody was waiting for stuff that they can capitalize and make as a series. Dune has never been a movie that would be that. I mean, maybe the only time this could have possibly been made and been absorbed by this public would have been sometime between 1968 and the release of 2001 A Space Odyssey and 1977 when Star Wars came out. That's really the only time that I think the Hollywood appetite for this movie would have worked. And yeah, everyone goes back to Jodorowsky's Dune and said, oh, Alejandro Jodorowsky would have done a great job because Nicholas Winding Refn made a movie out of it. I still go back. The description of what Jodorowsky's Dune would have been, I think would have been just as big of a mess, if not more. And it would have been a sick vanity piece. I think, honestly, David Lynch was trying in this one. And when you watch this movie, it is visually arresting. It is different than anything you've seen. It has some special effects that aren't great. But I think that's because they're dealing with budget overruns and stuff in post-production. But the scope was huge. Now, one of the things people complain about with this one is they had these weird little weirding modules, these little guns that made turn sound into laser beams. That has nothing to do with the book. The book had the weirding way, which was this way of doing martial arts. But I think that they couldn't do that because that was too close to the Jedi stuff. And they're already not wanting to get sued by 20th Century Fox because they were releasing this the year after Star Wars, The Return of the Jedi came out. So they made some changes to this. But I'm fascinated by this movie, and it's just an amazing thing to watch, and they throw so much at you. But I remember when I was rewatching it this week, and I said, you know, gosh, the first 15, 20 minutes of this movie is exactly what you'd get if you said, let's give $40 million to the guy who did Eraserhead to make an epic sci-fi movie. And you get exactly that. Yes, it's confusing. Yes, it's all over the place. No, there is not a shred of humor in this film at all. It's all done very seriously. And even though people are chewing the scenery throughout, I love existing in it. And I think it really is taking you into a different world. And people love to dump on this movie. And yes, they overdo stuff and the acting is a little bit over the top. And I will be the first to say the last 30, 40 minutes of this movie make no freaking sense. But that's okay. You just kind of have to go with it. And you just have to enjoy living in the moment. And this movie is a ride. I absolutely love this movie. It's still one of my favorite science fiction movies from the 80s. And I have, you know, been pounding the pavement saying, no, this is a good movie. People refuse to believe it's a good movie. And they love to just dump on it. But I'm like, remove yourself from what everyone says. It can't go in and say, well, it's different than the book. Remove yourself from the book. Well, Jodorowsky was going to remove yourself from Jodorowsky. Watch this movie for what it is on its own and dissect it. Dune is a fantastic and, dare I say, masterpiece of science fiction cinema that it's not for everybody, but it's a gorgeous, compelling, fantastic movie that has many different layers and a production and costume design that I've never seen duplicated. So I'm going to have to say Dune absolutely totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Also available this week, we've got In the Heights and Spirit Untamed as new movies. In vintage films, we've got Bugsy Malone, The Last Man on Earth, Coraline and the Box Trolls, both getting new releases. And that's it. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Malignant, Language Lessons, and Kate. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.